Hello and welcome to the virtual launch of Anna Lee Huber's latest book, A Fatal Illusion. I'm Jean Charles, and the Poison Pen is delighted to have with us one of our favorite historical mystery writers to celebrate the latest in her popular series. Before we begin today, I would like to let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of A Fatal Illusion, as well as all of Anna's previous books, and we would be happy to hold one or more for you or put them in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen bookstore. And now I'd like to welcome one of my favorite historical writers, Anna Lee Huber.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us again. My first question for you will be a familiar one, but I know readers often like to hear it. They want to know about who Anna was before you became a published author. I know I'm fascinated by how someone with a background in music who wanted to be a rock star ended up writing mysteries. How did that journey evolve?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, I loved books. And I actually started writing when I was, I think it was about third grade, fourth grade. And I was writing my own little stories, I had my own little mystery solving group, like Nancy Drew and all that, I loved to write. And then I got to junior high school, and that kind of fell by the wayside because I was busy with everything else. And music is my other big love. And that kind of took center stage. And I decided to go to college for music. I wanted to be a performer. So I majored in music, got out of college and realized, wow, I'm trained to be an opera singer, but I don't really want to be an opera singer. I was living in Nashville at the time. So I was trying to make it still as a performer. It's a tough business, I'll tell you. And I kept always getting the runner up for stuff. And I was working as an administrative assistant for an insurance company while I was trying to perform. And I rediscovered my love of reading. Because I was finally able to read what I wanted to read, not what the college classes had assigned. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, oh man, I remember when I used to write. And so I started writing again, just on a whim, just for fun. And I got the bug and I realized, ooh, this is what I really want to do. And it just fit the lifestyle I wanted also, because if you are a performer, I was starting to realize I was probably going to be a background singer, and those kind of things. And so I was going to be traveling on the road all the time. And, you know, if I had a family, when was I going to see them? And so I thought, you know, being a writer was much more appealing for the life I wanted to lead. So a backup singer, not background singer. Sorry. And so I started pursuing writing, and that's, you know, it took me 7 years to get my first book published. I had a learning curve because I didn't major in writing. So I had to figure all that out, but I love it. And I'm just so glad that I get to do it. And it's been a real blessing. So
it's kind of nice. There's a sense of synchronicity, I guess is the word I'm looking for, that your first published book was The Anatomist's Wife, which introduced us to Lady Keira Darby. What can you tell us about her and her partner in detection?
Sure. So Keira has a bit of a, when the series begins, she's pretty much at one of her blackest moments, the blackest moment of her life. Her first husband was not a nice guy. She has accrued this kind of reluctant knowledge of anatomy because he was a famous anatomist and he forced her to help him. She's a portrait artist, very gifted. And the first book in the series, she is kind of hiding away, just, you know, licking her wounds, you know, trying to figure out what to do with her life. And her sister is trying to push her back out there, and a body is killed and a woman is killed. And she is asked to help Sebastian Gage, who is a gentleman inquiry agent and a friend of her brother-in-law's. And they kind of team up reluctantly at first to solve this first mystery that's in The Anatomist's Wife, this first murder. And then they kind of end up, they continue to team up and a romance develops and all of that. And so by book 11, it's no surprise they're married, they have their first child, and they're still involved in all of these murder mysteries.
You kind of always knew from the beginning that you wanted that romantic thread to the series, didn't you?
Yes, I love a bit of romance with my mystery. I just feel like it's such a natural fit. Because, you know, the mysteries of the heart are just the most intriguing. And so, you know, they just kind of fit together. And I love history. And so weaving all those three elements is just my jam. I mean, it's what I love to read also. So, it was a natural fit for me.
That's great. What can you tell us about your latest now, A Fatal Illusion? Because you kind of hinted at it in the book before at the very end, so readers knew a little bit about what was coming.
Yeah, so in A Perilous Perspective, if you've read it, you get to the ending and Gage receives this letter from his father's villette, and his father has been attacked on the road, the Great North Road, coming to Edinburgh to see them. And there's, you know, it's just, he just discovers the attack. He has no idea whether he survived. It's as many days later. So they're racing to get to his father to find out, you know, to get to him before he dies, because that's the concern. They don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of strain in that relationship because of some things that Lord Gage has done. And in particular, he has a second son that was concealed from Sebastian. And Sebastian meets his brother Henry and discovers that he's his half brother. I think in a stroke of malice, we find out, and he finds out in a wicked conceit that they're brothers. So there's this strain definitely in the relationship of all of that and the secrets that his father's been keeping. And his father's not the easiest man to get along with to begin with. He's kind of one of those characters you love to hate. Mm-hmm. And so they racing to Yorkshire, where he was attacked. And they do arrive at the beginning, and I will say this, and he has survived, but he's not, you know, on necessarily on a smooth road to recovery. He has a ways to go. He's obviously not the kindest and in the best of moods because he has been injured and he's confined to a bed and he's trapped. He can't escape their questions. So there's a lot of still that contention, and also, you know, who attacked him and why, and are they finished or are they going to make another attempt? So there's a lot of little different mysteries to figure out, you know, and it weaves around this relationship of author, also the fathers and sons. Will they ever reconcile? So.
One of the things that you do brilliantly with each of the books in the series is how you pick certain historical, real historical facts, topics, and kind of use them as a springboard for your own plot. And without, we don't want to spoil things for people that haven't read the book, but can you talk a little bit about a few of the things that I found fascinating? First would be the Great North Road, because I've always read about that. I thought, you know, people getting on coaches and racing across England, that was their main, I guess, transportation route?
Absolutely, yeah. So the Great North Road went from London to Edinburgh. And it was the main transportation route before the train, and trains really, steam engines. So this is basically the last era, the last great era of the Great North Road, because steam engines took over in the 40s, 50s. And that's when that's the way people started to travel. But before, so this is the last 10 to 20 years of the real height of the Great North Road. And there's a lot of really interesting, fascinating stuff about it. I ended up picking Wentbridge because it's an area where it was the only spot where the road goes over the River Went for many, many miles. So, but it went down into this steep gorge, and they had to redid the road and blasted out the limestone to make a better path through, but it was still this deep gorge. And there's all these tales of people talking about having to get out and walk beside the carriage and all these things. And so it's just a very interesting little village. And there's these pubs there, which are fascinating, but there's also this kind of folklore that grows up around these toll roads, because, you know, people would stay in these inns, and there's these tales about, you know, bone pits and like people just disappearing and like, you know, kind of gothic tales that were like kind of almost penny dreadfuls of the time. So you can find these and read them. And some of them are just so completely ridiculous, but they're just fun to read now. But at that time, people would, you know, maybe believe them because, you know, they didn't know any better. So.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And in addition to those kind of urban legends of the time and things like that, you also kind of bring in another semi-historical figure, kind of a version of Robin Hood.
Yes. So when I was researching the area, once I settled on this Wentbridge area, I discovered that it was the original area called the Medieval Vale of Barnsdale. And that's where historically the the first ballads about Robin Hood set where he lived. It wasn't Nottingham. It wasn't Sherwood Forest. It was this medieval Vale of Barnsdale. And I thought, oh, how interesting. And there's all these different areas around there, even to this day, that you can stop and see this well that's supposedly Robin Hood's well. And there's a church of Mary Magdalene in Campsall, I think this the town Camp. Yeah, anyway, where he supposedly married Maid Marian and all these different things. And so I thought, I'm totally going to weave this in some way, because it fit. Also the fact I was using highwaymen, and so it just kind of all worked out.
It did, yeah. And in addition to that, you have the broader kind of historical political perspective in terms of the drama going on, and it's escaping me, but something about a massacre.
So the Grange Moor Rising was part of this bigger rising that actually happened about 10 years earlier, but it really affected this area. It was around, you know, when the economic depression around the Peterloo Massacre that happened in 1819 and all of that. And this was people that they were weavers. They were kind of middle class or lower middle class. They had good jobs, but they were losing them because of the economy and because of the Industrial Revolution and all these different factors. And they were trying to get the government to help them out in a peaceful way. And then the government started actually oppressing them. Like, you can read about these things they were doing, the laws they were passing. So they started to become more violent. And the Grange Moor Rising was part of that. And it was really fascinating because I'd heard of Peterloo. I'd heard of the massacre, but most people, you know, have no idea about the underlying political unrest and the fact that the government was sending in kind of undercover agents spying on these people. And so it's just really kind of a fascinating, you know, unsung moment that most people don't know about. And so I really enjoyed researching it.
It's almost like the precursor to what they tried to do to bust up the unions around the turn of the 20th century, when they would send policemen in and kind of try to infiltrate the groups and things. So history does go inside.
Repeat itself. Definitely.
Let's talk about your protagonist, Kira, because when you were creating her, you made some very smart choices. When you're doing historical sleuths, you have to give them a skill set that makes sense for them to become involved in crimes, whether it's murder or theft, whatever. You can't just have Lady, whatever her name is, along solving murders if she doesn't have something that makes it seem real to the readers as to why she's doing that. And you achieved that because you did, I think, at least two things that I'm aware of with Kira. One, you gave her that knowledge of medicine because she had to help her late husband with his anatomy textbook. So that gives her some insight into that kind of, we'll call it, crime scene analysis.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That was a deliberate choice because I had also decided I didn't want her to be this like society's darling, that I felt like there were some really well-written historical mysteries that already had female protagonists that were very charming and they were good at getting information from people in that way. And I was like, you know, I kind of want to flip it. I want the hero to be that way, but the heroine to be awkward and uncertain and, you know, say the wrong thing and all those kind of things. And so I thought, well, what could she bring to an investigation? Why are they going to let a gentlewoman look at a dead body? And I was like, well, what about the medicine? And so I had to figure out a creative way for her to have that knowledge that she could bring to the investigation. And, you know, it kind of becomes this theme also where she has to learn to accept the fact that she's learned all this information, that it's okay that she has, that it's a good thing that she has, and she can really use it to help society. So,
yeah. And then you did something else that did not hit me at first, and that's because I'm not always the most perceptive of readers, but it was actually really subtle and clever. You made her an artist, and in particular a portrait artist. And I never really thought about it, but when artists are doing someone's portrait, they really have to almost do a psychological profile of them.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I think that's somewhat where my music comes in, because it's an art. And so it makes me think of things in a different way. And also, you know, I have some art training also, and I know, you know, when an artist is working, you know, really a lot of it, I think I want to say it's like 80% is seeing what seeing the object for what it really is, and the lines and the shadows and all those kind of things, because if you're not seeing it, you can't capture it. And so I thought, wow, what a powerful, you know, what a powerful observation skill to be that portrait artist, to have those skills, to see those things. And so then she would see the things in people's eyes to be able to capture that on a canvas. And she'd wonder, and she'd catch clues that maybe other people would not. And, you know, it plays into that anatomy also, because she has to understand the anatomy to be able to draw a person. And what is she expecting to see there that's not there? So that kind of clue her into how they were killed or whatever. So,
yeah, no, that was very, very nicely done. For those that are new to your books, Sebastian Gage is a gentleman inquiry agent. Can you expand a little bit about, because people know probably about the Bow Street Runners and things like that, but how exactly does that fit into detection in England?
Sure. So in 1829 is the first time we have a police force in London. It's the first time any kind of uniform police force is established. Before that, it was the Bow Street Runners were the ones who were doing the detecting. And even after that, they're the ones who were doing the detecting, because the police were supposed to prevent crime. They weren't supposed to solve crimes after the fact. It wasn't for another decade or two that they actually established a investigation force for crimes that had already happened. So in this era, you know, if something went wrong, if something was stolen or somebody was murdered, you could hire the Bow Street Runners, but they were kind of low class and kind of rough, and they were prone to being, you know, some of them would take bribes because that's how they earned their income. I mean, it was, you paid them a tip basically for doing something for you. So these gentlemen inquiry agents were men that were of a better class. They were usually gentlemen or, you know, at least upper middle class and educated. They were hired, or they were just friends of whoever it happened to. And they just happened to be good at investigating and solving crimes and using what they knew. So they were kind of fascinating figures. And Lord Gage is the original inquiry agent, gentleman inquiry agent in the family. That's how Gage Sebastian gets brought into the family business, basically. And Lord Gage gets into it because he was a captain in the Royal Navy. He made his fortune from prizes, you know, the prize ships when they would take, you know, during the Napoleonic Wars, and that when they would capture a ship, they would get a certain prize amount.
Divvy it up.
And so he made his fortune that way. And he had good, he made friends with, he was on the ship with William IV, who is now the king in the 1830s, the early 1830s. He was not supposed to ever be the king, because George IV was supposed to just have an heir and, you know, he would just be another prince. So he was in the Royal Navy, and he actually served on a ship with Lord Gage. And so because he has that connection to the king, now the king, but and he has a connection to all these other nobles. And so then he helps them out, and then they help him out. And it's this kind of whole relationship, which, you know, can get tricky now, because his son Sebastian isn't so happy to be in the pockets of everybody.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Let's shift a little bit and talk about the setting, the historical setting for the book, because you picked kind of an interesting slot. There's a lot of series that the Regency era, both historical fiction, historical mysteries, romances, and then there's a lot, especially now, that have gone into the Victorian era, but you're kind of in between. So how does that fit into the timeline, and why did you say that's the period that I want to choose?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I chose it was exactly that reason. There's a lot of Regency, there's a lot of Victorian, but there's really this 7-year reign of William IV that, like, I hadn't been reading anything. And it felt like there was this pocket of time where people were not exploring. And once I started to look into it, I discovered how much really interesting history happens then. There's a lot of reforms that occur, especially political reforms. There's the Reform Act that changes the way that, you know, the different areas are drawn, so there's no more pocket boroughs and all these kind of things that were corrupt in the government. There's the Catholic Reform Act, and then the Anatomy Act, and there's a ton. There's just like 10 that occur within this, you know, just few years. And so it was not getting explored. And also with that Anatomy Act part, it's the end of the era of the body snatchers. And once I decided to give Kira that medical knowledge and that background with her husband, the anatomist, and the fact that he worked with body snatchers, because all anatomists and doctors and medical schools worked with body snatchers because they were a necessary evil because of the way the system was set up, which was why they needed the Anatomy Act. So it's that end of the era, and that Burke and Hare, the murderers turned body snatchers that were so horrible in Edinburgh that everybody panicked and it was such a scandal. So it was just all of that kind of rolled together. Was just, I realized this was the perfect era to set the series. I just can't even imagine it being set during another era because it just wouldn't work. So it was just kind of the perfect blend.
And she had recently written an article for a writer's magazine. And one of the things that you put in that article, once again, is so you and so perfectly encapsulated. You said you need, as a writer, you need to find the rhythm of your historical period. I'm thinking, okay, that you as a musician kind of, but what does that mean?
Yeah. So when I am doing my research, when I'm trying to write in a certain era, I talk about this a lot because I do write two series. One is the 1830s. One is the 1919 into the 1920s. And there's only 90 years different. But when you read the firsthand documents from that era, the letters and the memoirs and all those kind of things, you can feel that there's this different rhythm of the language and the way they spoke and the slang. And so when I'm writing, I have to feel it. Like, I know that I'm writing in the right heroine's head if I can feel that I'm writing in the right rhythm of that era and the intonation and the way they formed their sentences and all those kind of things. And it is the musician absolutely coming out in me that I think of it in those terms, but that's the only way I can describe it. Because to me, it's hearing that in my head and just the feel of it and all that. You know, the 1830s are more formal and fluid, and we got the 1920s, you're going into the jazz, and you can hear that in the way that they spoke. And so I just try to encapsulate that in my writing. And I think you can really bring that into any era you're writing, that concept.
A Fatal Illusion is the 11th in your series. You've been writing it for a number of years, I think more than a decade, possibly. What, if anything, has surprised you about Kira that you did not think you would find in her as a character?
Oh my goodness. So when I first started writing out, my hope, I had kind of planned out, because I mean, when you're writing, for those who might not know, if you're writing a series, usually you will get a contract for 2 to 3 books at a time. So it's not like you get a book for 10, you know, or a contract for 10, excuse me. So you write and you hope that maybe you get to write more than that. So when I first started out, I thought, oh man, you know, I had this story arc planned that basically took Kira through book 7, which is where I feature the London Burkers. And that's kind of the original arc that I had in my mind. And so the fact that I got to move beyond that, everything else was a surprise because I had not plotted beyond that, I guess is what I would say in my mind. That was like my wildest dreams. So I get to write more than 7 books in the series. So yeah, I would say basically everything beyond that, I kind of imagined that they would eventually have a child, but it might not be that we get to see it grow at all. So that was kind of fun to actually get to try to figure out how to weave that into the story. that was the big surprise, I guess, just that I get to write the series longer. And so I had to figure out more conflicts, I guess.
A happy problem.
Yes.
Writing series, and this is something as a reader I'm fascinated with, do you just automatically know it? Do you remember everything about it? How do you keep things straight? I mean, characters, secondary characters, where people live, you know, their particular likes or dislikes, or do you just kind of hope and pray it's going to work all out when you're writing?
So I have a series notebook for each of my series, and it's got certain sections, like it's got a character section, so I can, you know, what color were their eyes, and, you know, they had a kid then at this point, or they, you know, went to France or whatever that happens for them. And a big thing too is not repeating names, I have to say. I mean, so like, I'm like, how many, you know, have I used this name before? and then, you know, I have settings, I have different sections. So there's, you know, a timeline and settings and all those kind of things. That's the only way I can think of to keep it straight, because especially being 11 books in, it's just like, oh, mind blown. I mean, I feel like I would be getting it wrong all the time, especially because I have a lot of recurring secondary characters, but they may not have been in the book previously. So, you know, maybe 3 books since we saw that character. And so then I've got to go back and remind myself what they talked like and looked like and all those kind of things.
Does it surprise you at all, or is it challenging for you as an author? You've written a number of mysteries. How do you keep coming up with new ways of disposing of people?
Gosh, I don't know. I guess I don't know if that makes me have a macabre mind or what, but for me, every book starts with some small little thing that is the spark of the whole idea. It may be where I want to take a character to, something I want to explore. It could be a setting, it could be just something I want to do with the characters, or maybe it's an idea for a way to murder someone and I want to use it somehow, or all those kind of things. So like, for example, the germ of this book was that Lord Gage got injured. And I was like, okay, how could I feasibly have him get injured that they'd have to rush to get to him? And because it keeps him immobile and it forces them to have these conversations, because like he never would have if he had not been injured. So, you know, every book's different. But like, for example, book 12, which I'm working on right now, it'll be out next year. It's set in Cornwall, and I've been hinting at the fact that Lord Gage's maternal family is from Cornwall, that they're rogues and smugglers. He said this a couple times. And so I'm like, okay, who are these people? And I love Cornwall. I just love that area of the UK. And so I was like, this is my chance to get to use that and all of the stuff that goes on there. So yeah, it just depends on every book. And then usually, you know, for example, Cornwall, the murderer is basically inspired by something about Cornwall. So that helps me come up with ideas. So
you referenced it a bit earlier, but you write another series, the Verity Kent books. You're already have one popular series. What made you think, I want to write another series? And tell us a little bit about Verity.
Sure. Yeah. Verity, I've always wanted to write 2 series just because I wanted to have more than one book coming out a year. And so that just seemed like the optimal thing to have 2 series going. And Verity, I mean, honestly came about because there was a time where some of the publishers were having a bit of a rocky time and they were not issuing contracts. And I wasn't sure if I was going to get to write more Lady Darby. So I thought, well, let's just pitch some more stuff. And I was fortunate Verity got picked up and Lady Darby got picked up. And so then I had what I wanted. So, and Verity is set in post-World War I England. They traveled to some other places, but it's mostly England. She was a spy for British intelligence during the First World War, which was inspired by real women that were intelligence, that worked in the intelligence community in various ways. They kept their mouth shut, they kept quiet. And then when the records for MI6 and MI5 were released in the early 2000s, we discovered all these thousands of women that had worked and nobody had thought they had. They thought, you know, women really started in World War II. And so there was all these fascinating figures to work with and to study. And so she's like kind of inspired by all of them. And then her husband, who we believe in the first book, is dead, but realized, come to find out, he's alive. And so they work together in the later books in the series. And he was a war veteran. And so they're just kind of fun because they're, you know, she's got all these spy skills, but also they're kind of celebrities in their little day and age, you know, with going to the clubs and all those kind of things. And the photographs are in the papers, they're taking pictures of these society women going to these clubs. And so it's kind of it's fun. It's such a different era. It's only 90 years, but it's such a different era. Mm-hmm. And I can say that book 6 came out last year and book 7 is coming out next year. There's been a little gap, but they are going to Ireland and I'm really excited to tackle that. So that'll be something different. And anybody who knows 1920 Ireland, Dublin is a little bit of a scary place.
Yeah, it's definitely full of intrigue and danger. One of the things that I imagine for authors of series that would be challenging is how do you write each book so that a reader can approach it if they don't know anything about your characters, but make it fit into the overall scheme? And I think it's probably safe to say that you can read any of your books independently, but it's probably, there's layers to it if you're following along from the beginning. So how do you manage that with each book?
Yeah, it's definitely very tricky, especially when you first open the book, because you want somebody who's never read any of the other books to be able to pick it up and know enough that they can keep reading. But you also don't want to spend pages recapping for everybody else who's already read. So there's that really fine balance. I always have, I go through many drafts of the first couple chapters for that reason. And so it's a lot of it is, you know, that question of, do they have to know this in order to keep going forward or not? You know, if they do, then I need to recap. If not, then I don't. So, and even throughout the book, even there'll be times when you have to, oh, wait, I got to remind people, you know, this is what happened, or explain for somebody who hasn't read. So it's definitely a tricky balance. And the further you get into the series, it can get even trickier just because so much has happened. So yeah, it's a fine balance. I will say that. And sometimes I hope I get it right. That's all I can say.
But just in case anyone's tuning in and they might be hesitating, I don't want to read 10 books before I have to read book 11. You can read it and enjoy it on its own. It stands.
Absolutely. I always say all of the mysteries are self-contained within the book. You'll understand it. You'll be able to enjoy it and figure it out. It's more of the ongoing story arcs of the characters, you know, and their growth and, you know, maybe their disputes with each other and those kind of things. So you'll get a recap, but you won't have necessarily that depth of background. So
you have two series with traditional publishers, but you've also dabbled a little bit in indie publishing. Is that correct?
I have. I have a gothic novel. It's The Secrets in the Mist. and it was just a book that was kind of a book of my heart. It's been out for a while. I just adore gothics. I love them. Mary Stewart's my favorite author, Victoria Holt, those kind of authors. And so this is kind of an homage to them, because it was just fun to write. And I do have another book that's like 3/4 of the way finished that will come out eventually. It's just that I keep getting contracts from traditional publishers. It's an absolutely wonderful problem to have.
Yeah.
So I've got to meet those deadlines first. So, but yeah, there will be more hopefully. So, just kind of a fun side project.
It seems like there's almost been a renaissance in Gothic in terms of publishing again.
I agree. Yeah.
So, slot that in somewhere next year and finish it. Because two series aren't enough. You have another project that's coming. Can you tell us anything about that?
I do. One of my publishers approached me and asked me to write a book set on the Titanic. And at first I kind of balked a little bit, because, oh my goodness, Titanic is a big project. I mean, people know that. You cannot fudge it. You got to get it right. But I decided I would jump in and try. I would take the challenge. And so that book is coming out next spring. I believe it's in February or March. It's called Sisters of Fortune, and it is actually about a trio of sisters from Winnipeg, Canada. They were the Fortunes. That's actually their last name. Family. There was, 6 of them that were on the Titanic. They were first class passengers, millionaires. And so we find out what happens to them. I had a lot of fun researching that family. And I had never heard of them. And I just feel like people need to know who they are, because they're just very interesting and they'll capture your heart. So I hope people will look out for that. But yeah, that's out next year. So
it does sound fascinating. And there's so many real historical figures that you can play with when you're writing a book set on the Titanic, and all those wealthy people, not to mention the ones that were in steerage, that give you different
characters. Absolutely. It's almost, I mean, you can't, basically I wanted to use more than I could, you know. It's like you have to cut yourself off at one point. I mean, some point you can't have a cast list that's 200 people. So yeah.
Was it a challenge not to throw a dead body into the book, or did
you... No, not really. I think because of the way I wrote it, I was really constrained because I had to really follow that timeline of what happened in the Titanic. So a lot of it was so constrained by that, that it would be a little hard to to throw that dead body in. No. Yeah, maybe a little bit of an urge, but yeah, I resisted.
In addition to writing, I know you're also a big reader. Is there anything that you recently have that you'd like to share with us?
Sure. Yeah. So I recently read a book called The Enchanted Hacienda.
Yes.
I cannot remember the author's name, but it's wonderful. Cervantes. It's wonderful. That's a good one. And then I'm currently reading The Antiquity Affair.
Yeah.
Which I'm really, really enjoying. It's kind of Indiana Jones, but with two sisters, and it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Then The Paris Deception by Bryn Turnbull.
Yeah, she's an amazing writer.
Yes. Art, yes. Forgeries. I mean, right up my alley.
She did something on Wallace Simpson or something, if I...
Yes, she did.
The other Mrs. Simpson or something, I can't remember, but it was an amazing book.
She's a wonderful writer.
And then something that I think is relatively new to you, I was doing a little bit of research and I discovered that when it comes to social media, you've branched out into book talk.
I have. Yeah. It's been fun. I'm dabbling. I'm finding my way. Authentically making flubs probably, but that's okay.
Well, you really, I especially enjoy your little chats with other authors because they're just so interesting and you kind of get a sense of what their books are about. They're like a commercial in the best possible way, I guess.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. I thought, you know, as authors, you're always trying to think of content, you know, for your social media or what have you, but you don't want it to always be about yourself because it just feels like, you know, and I thought, you know, I have all these author friends and all these authors I admire just from reading their books. I could do this. This is, you know, 2 minutes of, you know, just give people a little pitch about what their book's about. And hopefully it, you know, helps them have sales and it lets me have fun, you know, and it gives me content. So, so I'm enjoying doing that.
That's great. Are you on other social media platforms that we should be aware of?
I am. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and I have a YouTube channel also. And so I post, for example, those author highlight videos to all four of those. So you can catch them on any of them.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. We do have some of your dedicated fans that have sent in a few questions. So we'll take a minute and pause for those lest we run out of time. One of the first questions that came up was if you could talk a little bit about how important the right title is to your books, as well as the cover, and what input do you have as an author?
Sure. So the title is definitely important. You know, with the Lady Darby series, there's kind of a formula, obviously. There's some kind of term that's death, murder, whatever you, what have you, and then there's like an art term. And so it's getting a little tricky at this point because we're running out of really obvious art terms. So, and some of them, it's like stretching it a little bit to try to use. So at some point we may have to alter it a little bit, but so far we're good. Cause I have the titles for 12 and 13. I can share book 12, which is a deceptive composition. So that works.
It does. And it works on several levels because
yes, exactly. And we try to find words that work with what's going on and all those kind of things. So, and then the Verity Kent series, we have to find the right title. Sometimes I work with my editors and my agent chimes in and sometimes they get their, copy department even to chime in just to give us ideas. And it's kind of a collaboration. Sometimes they come up with it. Sometimes I do, or we bounce ideas off each other because, you know, maybe there's a title they love, but I'm like, yeah, but that doesn't really fit what's going on in the book. And so we'll try something else. It's definitely important for me to find the right title or it just feels like it doesn't work. And then the covers, it's also kind of a collaboration. I usually get asked, before they go into their cover conference, that's what the publishers have, where they talk to the art department and first come up with ideas for the covers. I always send ideas. Sometimes I send pictures of either locations or clothing or what have you that I think would go well with the cover. So And sometimes they take my ideas and sometimes they don't. Usually they come back with something even better. So I don't, you know, sweat it. So a lot of times it's a collaboration in that way. So it's partly my ideas, partly theirs. They usually want you to be happy. So, I mean, I rarely have had them do something I don't like that they didn't adjust for me. So, yeah.
The next question is actually rather interesting. When you're writing your mysteries, do you always know at the very beginning who did it and how it was done and all the clues that you want to plant, or do you have to go back and clean up things when you're...
So when I first started writing, I always knew who was the murderer, the culprit. Mm-hmm. And then I kept writing these books and I would get to the end and I'd realize somebody else would stand up and said they did it. And so then I had a whole lot of editing to do because it was like way better. And I was like, oh no, I'm going with this. So now I kind of write open-ended until I get maybe 75% of 80% of the way through the book, because I need to make it foil everybody anyway. I mean, you need to have those red herrings. And so I get to that point and then I have a much better idea of where I really want to go. And so then I feel like I'm wasting less time making those, you know, adjustments. I still have some adjustments to make, but it's not as big. And it's also just fun for me because I do plot, but I only plot to a certain point, and I plot pretty loosely because I find when I write, I have so much better inspiration and I'm in the story and I'm feeling the characters. And so if I constrain myself too much, I don't enjoy it as much. So getting to discover those things for myself while I'm writing is part of the fun.
I guess in a way, and I'm probably going to get the term wrong, but musicians, when they kind of are playing along and then they kind of improvise whatever.
Yes.
To a piece.
It's the same kind of thing, definitely.
The next person would like to know what your average writing day looks like. Do you always have a certain routine? Does it vary book by book?
Yeah, so when my kids are in school, summer's always kind of madness. When my kids are in school, I get them on the bus and I sit down at about 7:30 and check email and do some small things just to see whether there's something I need to tackle right away. And then I dive in and optimally I write first and then save a lot of the other more tedious, like less concentrated stuff for later, making graphics and answering emails and all those kind of things. So I get to write, you know, with lunch breaks and all those kind of things from 7:30 to 2:30 when my kids get off the bus. And then, I get them off the bus and I help them with homework and I, you know, run them places and I check email and make graphics and things when I'm sitting in the car or whatever. My husband and I both actually work from home. So some days he actually watches them and I get to write into the afternoon. So I get extra time in. But that's really what my day looks like optimally. Summer, it's kind of a free for all. So they're home and are they letting us work or not? So
your next fan would like to know, what do you love most about the writing process? And maybe it's not what you hate or what you dread, I guess, what you don't enjoy, what you enjoy the least about the writing process.
I think what I enjoy the most is those sparks of ideas, because they're just exciting, whether it's starting a whole new book or I'm in the middle of a book and I have a spark of an idea that's just, you know, it gets me excited and gets my brain moving. And I just love that. It's kind of like a high almost, you know. And what I hate the least has to be, there always comes a point in the book, at some point, it's always in the middle somewhere, where I feel like this is never going to work. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to give up. I'm never going to finish this. And it happens every time, even though I know it, I still get so like down and for a couple days and then I power my way through it, you know, but that's always my least favorite place to be, I guess.
Your next reader would like to know, what is the best piece of writing advice you've ever received? And what would you give to an aspiring writer?
I think the best advice I can give is, or that I've even been given, is that you have to write. I mean, you can't say you want to be a writer and then you fiddle around and you don't really put any words on the page. I mean, I even say this to myself sometimes, because it's like the idea in your head is always going to be this sparkly, wonderful, perfect thing. And then as soon as you try to put it on the page, it's a mess, you know, and you just have to give yourself permission to get the crap out. Just get it on the page. It's going to be messy and that's okay. And you can edit it. And this is how every writer writes. Nobody sits down and writes and it's beautiful, it's wonderful prose. So,
Not even Nora Roberts.
Right. So, I mean, I would say you just got to get in there and get messy. And I think too many people get stalled out because of that, you know, and also that, you know, the idea of I can only write when I feel like it and my muse is striking and all that stuff. If you're a professional writer, you got to write whether you want to or not, because you got a deadline to meet. So, you know, you just have to get pushed past those things. That's my advice. That's the advice that's helped me the most that I still have to give myself and remind myself of. And I also like to recommend, you know, if you're seriously wanting to pursue this, you know, find those professional writers organizations that are for your genre. For example, the Mystery Writers of America, they have a chapter called the Guppies that's for new authors or people who want to be authors that are not published yet. And they have so many amazing, wonderful resources for those authors, those aspiring authors. So, you know, go find those organizations. I know there's, you know, many for different genres. So find the genre that fits what you're wanting to write or you are writing and, you know, join those and get those resources and that help. And yeah, that's what I always suggest that, because, you know, you'll find way more than I can tell you. So.
another writer really this year had explained something, this concept to me in a way that I thought was kind of smart. She said, there's a difference between being a writer and an author. A writer is someone who sits down every day and does the work. The author is the person who goes on tour and signs books and does the PR moments. And I think people are kind of, if you haven't never written, you're kind of enamored with the idea of being the author, but you don't necessarily equate the part of being the writer with that.
I like that. I have never heard that before, but yeah, I like that because it's spot on. I mean, it is. It's
credit.
The author is that glossy thing you see on TV and on movies and, you know, whereas, you know, writer, it's very different. It's the down in the trenches, and you rarely see the author.
Two different people. Well, we're almost out of time. I can't believe it's flown by so quickly. Can you remind us again a little bit about your new book, A Fatal Perspective?
Yes. So A Fatal Illusion.
That's
okay. It's Lady Darby book 11. And Gage and Kira are racing to find out what happened to Gage's father and why he was attacked. And is he still in danger? And is he alive? And all those kind of things. And I will say next up for me is Sisters of Fortune, the Titanic book that's next year. And also Lady Darby book 12 will be out next year in June. And then my next Verity Kent book 7 will be out in autumn of 2024. So three books next year.
You have riches. And if readers want to know more about your books and you have a website?
I do. My website's annaleehuber.com. And there is links to all of my social media that's there. So just go to that website and you can get to any of them. So
thank you so much, Anna. I can't believe it's just been a jam-filled hour of information and fun. Your new book is delightful. Thank you for sharing it with us, sharing time with us. Thank everyone for tuning into your virtual launch. We're delighted to have you here at the Poison Pen, whether in person or virtually.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for tuning into another author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.